winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is a New York Now special edition, the 20th Congressional District Debate.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of New York Now. I'm Casey Seiler. Tonight's debate is brought to you by WMHT-TV and the Times Union. The 20th district candidates are Democrat Paul Tonko of Amsterdam and Joe Vitolo of Queens. I will be your moderator, and I'm joined by Times Union political reporter Rachel Silberstein. Next to Rachel, also from the Times Union, Lauren Stanforth. And finally, the managing editor and my co-host on New York Now, Matt Ryan, who will be monitoring questions on social media. We are allowing you the chance to have an active role in the debate. If you want to ask the candidate something, you can do so by logging on to our Facebook account, just like us, and submit, or on Twitter, where our handle is at NYNow_PBS. Just use the hashtag NY20. We'll have those reminders up on our screen during the program. All right, let's go over the rules. Each candidate will be given 1 minute for their opening statement. After that, we will begin the formal questioning from our panel. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to answer, while the other can offer up to a 45-second rebuttal. If a panelist believes an answer needs clarification from one of the candidates, they can then ask a follow-up question. That person will have up to 30 seconds to clarify. Before the debate, we flipped a coin to determine the order for our opening and closing statements. Joe Vitolo won the toss and elected to make the final closing statement. So that means up first is Mr. Vitolo. Good evening, and your 1 minute starts now.
Hi, I'm Joe Vitolo, running for Congress here. I'm the fourth child of six children born to a first-generation Italian-American, Rose Malanga Vitolo, who, after my father left, I was 6 years old. She raised us on her own with very little help from pretty much anybody. So because I was concerned about, even as a young age, how we would pay the rent, my mother crying about it, I went and I shined shoes at 7.5 years old. At Babylon train station, rode my bike. And then I scrapped metal on the streets in Bayshore, Long Island, where I grew up. And you know what? I grew up to run for Congress. That's the American dream. The American dream is you can start out poor and you could grow up to run for U.S. Congress. I believe in middle America. I believe in the average working class man. And I believe that the Capital District and middle America and upstate New York is done with lifetime politicians.
Mr. Tonko, your 1 minute opening statement.
Thank you, Casey, and good evening. I'm Paul Tonko, running for re-election in the 20th District. I'm a grandson of immigrants and a product of a mill town. I am running for re-election for many reasons, but let me state that I appreciate WMHT and the crew offering us this opportunity, and my opponent Joe Vitolo for joining us so that we can share with the electorate out there. The first and important reason, I think, is that I have always worked across the aisle, will continue to do so to deliver for the greater Capital Region. We have fought the opioid epidemic, we have invested in water infrastructure, and we have made certain that we continue to work to provide health care options for individuals out there. We need to serve as a check and balance. That's a legislative responsibility. I believe that the Republican majority has abdicated the responsibilities to check so that we can importantly maintain the independence of Investigator Mueller in the investigation of hacking into our elections, and also to maintain the balance that is out there that is needed for the legislative branch to interact.
All right. All right, thank you very much. Before I hand things off to the panel, I will take moderator's prerogative to ask the first question, and it's for Mr. Vitolo. There's been a lot of talk about the attempt to return civility to our political discourse. However, your Twitter feed in recent months has included attacks on your opponent in which you have called him senile, a, quote, whining little chicken, and a sissy. Do you think this kind of rhetoric is appropriate, and who in the 20th District is it meant to appeal to?
Well, the bottom line is that a lot of those quantifications regarding my opponent has a lot to do with his attacks on the president and his attacks on the winning America that we have right now. Let's face it, America is moving forward. America is gaining ground. We're seeing a booming economy. We're seeing jobs being created. We're seeing unemployment at its lowest. And he has complained and whined about things that have gone on. And I think that the truth is, although it seems maybe harsh, I think that we can comment, and he has made comments back as well that have not been kind as well. So I think that, you know, we can, you know, go over this whole issue of name calling. But the truth is that we need to look at America and stop complaining about everything that other people are doing and say, what are we doing to move forward? Mr. Tonko has had 40 years to fix this area. Two more years isn't going to make it any better. We've lost hundreds of thousands of jobs, factories, farms. We've lost industry. We have still record unemployment in this area. Unemployment in this area for our minorities. And the bottom line is he is not meeting those needs. I say, give me a choice. Give me a chance, and I will make a difference in this area.
Mr. Tonko, you have 45 seconds to respond.
Right. I believe the question was about setting a tone of civility in government across our country. I believe that as an engineer, I'm a problem solver, and I address issues in an analytical way. When I disagree or debate over those issues, it's on substance, it's on facts, it's on data. I don't choose to attack individuals personally. I think all of us who assume office or look to assume office have that moral responsibility to set a good tone. Civility is very important. The harshness that we have seen from some leaders in this country have divided us, have chastised various religions, ethnicities, races. I don't think that's leadership. I think we need to heal as a nation, and it calls for the civility to be started by the tone set by elected officials in this nation.
All right. And now to our panel. Mr. Tonko, your first question comes from Rachel Silverstein.
Congressman Tonko, Democrats in Congress oppose the Republican effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Short of implementing Medicare for All, what should Congress do now in the short term to address rising marketplace premiums?
Well, I think that there are a number of things that can be done, Rachel. I think it's important for us to look at providing additional subsidies that will enable more people from the middle-income community to be able to afford and have access to health care. I believe that a separate public option where there isn't enough competition in some of the regions of our country or in some states needs to be offered so that there is that sharpening of the pencil on behalf of the consumer. And I think we need to rein in the price of pharmaceuticals out there by doing some very important reforms that will make the outcome all the more consumer driven. I think that the achievements that have been made by the Affordable Care Act with pre-existing condition protection is an outstanding benefit that has enabled people, 20 million people in the country, to have insurance for the first time, and in many cases have enabled them to have insurance and not be discriminated against. So I think those benefits need to be protected as we continue to advance an opportunity. I think there's also a universal insurance networking that we can do that assumes some of the risk for insurances out there with a pool that will enable them, if they get an onslaught of high needs consumers that they're insuring, to have a benefit that enables them to, again, provide stability and certainty for the ratepayer. It's a crowning achievement. We need to go forward and continue to improve, not repeal. There was never a replacement, only a repeal.
Mr. Vitola, your response.
Okay, my response starts out with this. First of all, my opponent talks about reining in pharmaceutical companies. He has taken upwards of almost $500,000 over the course of 10 years in campaign finances from pharmaceutical companies. I have a hard time believing that those companies are giving him that money to rein them in. And secondly, as far as 20 million people being uninsured and now they are insured, I work in the emergency room. I'm a registered nurse. I have never seen anybody turned away at the door. I've never seen anybody not getting care. It is a fallacy that there are things that are being provided now that weren't being provided before. The only difference is that it's spread. It's making more tax dollars pay for it instead of private hospitals.
And now to Lauren Stanforth with a question for Mr. Vitola.
Yes, hi. Good evening, Ms. Fratullo.
Good.
You stated on your campaign website that the national debt is currently over $2.7 trillion and that, quote unquote, this cannot continue.
$27 trillion.
$2.7 trillion.
Yeah. Must have been an error.
According to the Congressional Budget Office, the GOP's recent tax cut bill will increase the national debt by $1.8 trillion. Did you support the GOP's tax cut plan? And if so, why?
Well, first of all, we'll clarify. The national debt is $27 trillion with an interest rate of $178 million a day. That needs to be brought under control. And I do support the recent tax cuts because what it did was it allowed for industry and manufacturing to be free to begin to open up, create jobs, and stimulate the economy. So what is going to happen, although it has increased the debt, and part of that had to do with concessions that had to be made in order for the budget to be passed, in the following budget, there will not be an increase in the debt and in the deficit, and there will be a decrease in the debt. We are looking at, we're going to see record tax revenues coming in that's going to offset a lot of that whole idea of this big, what it had cost us for increasing the deficit and the debt. So those record revenues are going to offset all of that. So I agree with the tax cut. And I also realize that people need to understand that 83% of the people in our district benefited from those tax cuts. And although my opponent has stated that there are people that have been hurt, it's people who are wealthy that have been hurt, not people who are poor. And I always thought that he was in favor of taxing the rich.
Mr. Tonko.
Yes, Lauren, thank you for your question. I believe that what we saw here was the largest historic increase in national debt because of this tax cut plan. It's a very hurtful plan for middle-income America. It is one that allows for permanent cuts to corporations and temporary cuts. If you're making under $75,000, you'll see an increase when this tax cut is taken away. When it's out there for a few years, you will see an increase for the middle-income community. But I think what's most important here is that when we're trying to grow the economy, the previous administration cut the deficit in half. And now we see the old familiar historic run where as you cut those deficits and as you work on the deficit, you have a Republican administration again raising debt.
All right. Thank you. And now to Matt Ryan with a question for Mr. Tonko.
Oh, we're getting a lot of questions in social media, which is good. Keep them coming. A lot of the ones we've received so far are on our list, so I guess we're all thinking along the same lines. So this question is for Mr. Tonko. There's a question of who's going to be the next leader of the House, you know, whether the Republicans retain control or the Democrats take the House. Can you tell us today who you would vote for as Speaker if the Democrats get the House?
Right. Well, I believe that the Democrats will take control of the House. The field for Speaker has not been defined. I know that there are many people who have talked with great interest of leading our caucus if we should be successful. In the past, I know that Leader Pelosi, now Leader Pelosi, then Speaker Pelosi, was very effective in making certain that the values of this 20th Congressional District were spoken to through her leadership, making certain that we fight for working families, that we deliver accessibility and affordability for health care. We would not have had the Affordable Care Act and those pre-existing conditions had it not been for her leadership. So I know that from the past, she has exerted great leadership, great negotiating skills, and really delivers on middle-class values. What that field will look like is undefined right now, and so I will hold judgment until that field is defined. But I do know that through experience, there have been many, many issues that have been advanced. She is very strong on protecting the environment, and she's very strong in making certain that we grow jobs, meaningful jobs, in this innovation economy that also requires workforce development, for which she stands to lead us in developing training and retraining opportunities.
Mr. Vitolo, Republicans will not have a choice of an incumbent this time around.
I don't understand the question.
Feel free to respond. I was just pointing that out.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, there will be a change in the speaker. And the speaker, you know, I personally would stand behind Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan, who leads the Freedom Caucus, who promotes smaller government, less taxes, reducing the waste in federal government. There is an incredible amount of waste. We do not want to cut services, but we want to hone down on the delivery of services. It's what needs to take place. And the previous administration did not cut the deficit in half. They actually tripled the debt. So the deficit is like a funny little word there. It has to do with what you're spending, not versus what debt you have. So, but to get back to the point of what is going on in America, my time is up.
And on that note, back to the top of the order with Rachel Silberstein with a question for Mr. Vitolo.
Mr. Vitolo, should President Trump and Republican leaders more explicitly condemn white nationalism in the Republican Party in light of the recent hate crimes in Pennsylvania and Kentucky?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think anybody should get behind white nationalism. But I believe in American nationalism. I believe white, black, Chinese, or any Asian culture, Spanish culture, I believe we should have nationalism. This should, you know, FDR made this statement. There's only room in this country for one flag, the American flag. Now, we can hold on to our culture and our cultural beliefs and our spiritual beliefs, but when it comes to nationalism, if you're going to come to this country and you're going to live in this country, we need to stand up for the American flag. We need to stand up for American values and stand up for American rights. Stand up for middle America. Those farmers out there, they're flying that flag. They're white, they're brown, they are Chinese. We have farmers of every nationality. We have middle Americans that are of every nationality. So I condemn any kind of efforts that would attack anyone. Listen, there's no one who's a greater advocate for the Jewish population than myself. If it were not for a Jewish family that took me in the early years of my teenage life, I would probably be a casualty in America. So I love the Jewish community. They've done great things for me, and because of that, I've worked very hard on doing great things for them.
Mr. Tonko.
Rachel, I believe that the goal of government should be to stamp out discrimination and to witness that encouragement where we have seen division reign supreme has been talked about throughout the district. I recently went to two memorial services back to back, Sunday and Monday, to pay respects to the victims of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. There was a coming together, an ecumenical coming together, where people shared their thoughts. And in conversation, you could just hear the concern for our nation, that we have been divided by leadership. That leadership should stand up and speak out in defense of the diversity of this great country. That is our hallmark. That is our great treasure. And it should be defended and advanced and promoted to freedom-loving people around the world.
All right. And now to Lauren Stanforth with a question for Mr. Tonko.
Yes, Congressman Tonko. You received some national exposure with your pushback of former EP Administrator Scott Pruitt. But other than that, you have had what some might describe as a lower profile during what many consider to be one of the most turbulent times in this country's modern history. Do you think you could do more to provide a strong Democratic voice on the national stage?
Absolutely. Lauren, when you talk about the Scott Pruitt, Administrator Pruitt situation, yes, I was very vocal because I'm the ranker on the Subcommittee of Environment. I continue to be outspoken there because it's a culture of corruption. I highlighted Administrator Pruitt as one of those examples of the culture of corruption that has been encouraged by this latest administration. We need to do better. I have spoken out about the impacts on middle-income community through the tax cut debates that we had. I go to the floor routinely and speak forcefully to those issues. I believe that there is this need for us to make certain that there is a driving force for working families, and that the injustice that is produced by some of these positions and some of these policy efforts are going to be very painful. So I have asserted myself in very many ways, joining with colleagues with special order, where we will address some of these topics after session in what are one-hour opportunities to share our thoughts. I have done it in committee assignments, both in science, space, and technology, and in energy and commerce. I have spoken forcefully about the cuts to the replacement effort that wasn't there when they were attempting to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And I talked about preserving the pre-existing condition protection. So I've been very forceful in those comments. I think that, yes, there's a need for us to crank up the volume because I'm worried for our country and many programs that had been defended through the decades, including Social Security and Medicare.
Mr. Petola.
Well, first I want to go back to almost the very first statement that he said, going after the culture of corruption. The culture of corruption begins in Congress, begins in the Senate, begins in Washington, D.C., and needs to be changed. Let's face it, when you have people who take $800,000 in special interest money over the course of a year, who do you think that they are going to represent in Washington, D.C.? They're not going to represent me. They're not going to represent the people who give them that money. And as far as being outspoken, I read that article in the Times Union, and it said that you have not been an effective legislator. And really, the only reason why you're on that commission is because you have taken a lot of money and bought that seat the DNC.
Okay. And now the next question is from Matt Ryan, and it goes to Mr. Vitolo.
Mr. Vitolo, we got a question from Kayla on Twitter. Who says she's 35 years old, she has a master's degree, and $150,000 of student loan debt. She's asking, is the American dream dead?
Is it? I'm sorry.
In other words, you know, she's got a master's her field. She's got all this debt. She can barely pay her bills. I guess in frustration, she's asking, you know, is the American dream dead?
Well, the American dream is not dead. The American dream is alive, and there are jobs that are being created, and America is exploding with progress. And so I think that a big problem that we have in with debt when it comes to student loans is because we have pushed people forward that education, which is important, at what expense? And so the question is, what's the matter with the system when someone gets a master's degree? The problem is we have professors who are being paid exorbitant amounts of money, and these students have to buy their books, which they rewrite every year, which cost a fortune. And so they have that debt not because they've been pushing for the American dream, but because those who run the universities, those who run our education system, they have made profit off of the students. And what that lady needs to do, and Kayla needs to do, is Kayla needs to stand up and say, there's something wrong with the way we get our education. Now, I empathize with her. I have student debt myself, and I'm still paying it off. And it's a struggle. And I think there are ways that we can help people with that by providing incentives and maybe some credits if they could do some community activities that would help them with their debt and help America at the same time.
Mr. Tonko.
Well, I appreciate the question. I think that it's important for us to keep that American dream alive. Student debt is at $1.4 trillion. It has surpassed credit card debt by some $650 billion. It's why I support legislation that would allow for students to refinance their college loans. If we can do it for homes and various other entities, let's do it for college education. And I oppose the PROSPER bill that was brought by the Republican majority that would have gutted higher education opportunity by some $15 billion. I support an increase in Pell Grants to enable that American dream to continue and support community colleges, which are many times the gateway to higher education for many of the families that I represent. So I share your concern.
And now to Rachel Silverstein with a question for Mr. Tonko.
Congressman Tonko, some of your colleagues have called for ICE to be abolished after the Trump administration implemented a policy of separating parents and children at the Mexican-American border. Should ICE be abolished, and should local law enforcement cooperate with federal agents to deport undocumented immigrants who have committed minor offenses?
Well, I think ICE was created for a particular situation. Should it be abolished? Regardless if you abolish it or not, there are going to be these assignments that are necessary in order to have border control and sound immigration reform. I think that the custom and border patrol issues are those that should be speaking to some of these efforts that ICE has overtaken. I think ICE should not concentrate on going to situations where innocent victims are being pulled out of jobs that many people won't assume. Ask the agriculture community, ask the healthcare industry about those jobs. They are going in and approaching people in very unusual places, in hospitals, in churches and houses of worship, and they are victimizing the very innocent out there by broad brushing. They should be going after those situations that they know are fraudulent or are criminal in nature. They should be weeding out those individuals for making our border situation all the safer. And I think ICE has been used in a way that it was not intended. We'll have the Custom and Border Patrol efforts. They can do their job. And I think ICE should supplement that by making certain that it focuses on those situations that are going towards totally criminal aspects and not going across some of these industries. We hear routinely from the farming industry, the hospitality sector, the restaurant industry, they have been threatened by the ICE operations that have really impacted them, and they're looking at difficult times to fill some of these positions. So I think it's been overutilized and incorrectly utilized.
Mr. Vitolo.
I believe there's an over-dramatization here about them going into restaurants and homes and farms and churches and pulling people out and dragging them away. It's drama. And that's the problem here in America and the problem in politics. People need to stop with the drama. I mean, when it comes to civility and incivility, there's drama. You look at Maxine Waters, it's dramatic. ICE has been responsible for stopping sex trafficking. ICE has been responsible for stopping felons from crossing the border, people who were criminals, stopping drugs. ICE has done phenomenal things. And do I think that they need to continue? Absolutely. And they need to be strengthened. They're doing great things here. And you have called for the abolishing of ICE. 9 times on your Twitter site have you done that.
Okay. And now to Lauren Stanforth with a question for Mr. Vitolo.
Yes, Mr. Vitolo. Recently, you shared a post on your Facebook page that suggested the current caravan of Central Americans marching to the U.S. border is an event staged by Democrats before the midterm elections. You also retweeted an image suggesting pedophiles should be hung. Do you think sharing these kind of posts is responsible?
I retweeted an image of pedophiles being hung? Well, first of all,
yes.
We'll start with this. As far as the immigrants coming towards the border, I believe that there is incredible influence. We know that there were people, there is footage, there's film of people being paid to get involved in that caravan. That money is not coming from the Honduras country. That money, from a very poor country. That money is coming from someone, Soros, whoever it might be.
Where's that footage from? Where did you see that?
It was on a news feed. I saw it on a news feed, a South American news feed.
A South American news feed.
But still, the footage is there. People are being paid to get on that caravan. And so they are coming towards America. That's actually a second question in the middle of your question. But that footage shows people being paid to get on that caravan. And that caravan has no right to come and barge our border. America is a country of borders. Any country that doesn't have borders is not a country at all. It's very important that we secure our borders. We have enough going on in America without overburdening the system by bringing people in. Now, these people might be fleeing something. Mexico has offered them to stay. They're still coming towards America. Why? Mexico offered them to stay. They're not staying. Why? Because they were paid to come to our border and make something dramatic take place during the midterm
elections. So you believe it's some kind of conspiracy, the caravan?
I'll give you 30 seconds for that clarifying question.
So you believe that it's some kind of conspiracy involved with the caravan of Central Americans?
I believe that the conspiracy is another theatrical event that is being staged by those who oppose a president who is successful in this country, leading us in economic opportunities, leading us in jobs, leading us in a boom that we have not seen in 50 years. And I'd like to bring that here to upstate New York. How come we're not experiencing it? How come we're not experiencing it? Because the control in upstate New York is crushing it and won't let it.
Mr. Tonko.
Well, we just heard about drama in politics. This is drama. This is hurtful drama, antagonistic drama, non-factual drama. So I think that, again, we should make certain that we're addressing our borders and doing it in a very high-tech fashion. We're not the ancient Chinese that built walls along their borders. We need high-tech. But I do also want to quickly make mention, when you talk about special interest dollars, I defy anyone to look through my record, my track record of voting in Congress. My opponent just mentioned earlier the pharma industry, the drug prescription drug industry. It's my record to have voted for a bill that goes against the grain of the companies with a pay-to-delay concept that we would deny. And so look at my track record before you suggest anything other than
all
the
right.
facts.
And now to Matt Ryan with a question for Congressman Tonko.
All right, gentlemen, Al from Clifton Park is asking you each to kind of explain your philosophy and guiding principles regarding public sector versus private sector roles in providing for the common good and in providing safety nets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my turn. It goes to you first.
I thank Al for the question. I think public-private is a good partnership. It's one that can work very well in this country. You know, I've always believed that the private sector and capitalism as it exists is a good strengthener to our economy. But there's a public sector that serves a very useful role. It goes where government cannot or will not go. I have done a lot of work in mental health policy. I have made certain that we do not stepchild those who need assistance, who have mental illnesses or mental health disorders. If mental health policies and services don't make a profit, we in government can't take it off the shelf. But the partnership that we offer private sector in that regard is a wholesome workforce. It enables us to go forward with dignity and with an opportunity to address the healthcare needs of their workers. So the public-private partnership in this country can work tremendously well. When people talk about reducing the size of government, I think the more important question and more important exercise is how do we make government more effective? That has been my goal as I work in a bipartisan fashion, working across the aisle to make certain that we put together programs that will empower the private sector, but at the same time provide for dignity and respect and speak to the needs, the outstanding needs of the workforce, of people of this great country, so that together we can provide for dignity.
Mr. Vitola.
I believe that the public sector is probably the strongest and most important part in our society. Government does not begin in Washington. Government begins in the home. Government begins amongst the people. And ruling begins amongst the people. If we allow the private sector to do what they used to do, instead of all this government regulation that has strangled them and has taxed them to the point to where they can't do anything, it makes a way for the government to become daddy. And we need to get the government out of our lives. And as far as the mental health community is concerned, Paul, there was a situation that was brought to you 5 years ago. 5 years ago in the mental health community.
I'm going to have to cut you off in the middle of that. And we go on to our next question from Rachel Silverstein for Mr. Vitola.
This week, President Trump announced his intention to sign an executive order ending citizenship rights for babies born to non-citizens on U.S. soil. Do you think that this is wise, and do you think this order is constitutional?
Executive orders have been used by presidents for years and years and years, and the previous administration used executive orders way beyond the powers that the president's reach should be. So immediately I noticed that the attack is the executive order presidential or right or constitutional? Listen, when you start to use these anchor children to bring people in, all right, the baby was born here. And I'm glad the baby was born here. I'm glad the baby was born safe. I'm glad the baby is alive and healthy. And I think that that's a phenomenal thing that we provide in our country. that people can come here as non-citizens and they end up having a child, and we provide a healthy birth for that child. Well, that child needs to go with its parents and become a legal citizen the way everyone else becomes a legal citizen in this country. It was never the practice of this country. When my grandparents came over, my grandparents had to have a job, they had to have a sponsor, and my grandparents had to be able to show that they were going to provide for themselves when they came to this country. And so I don't believe that we should allow anchor children to give people the right to stay here.
But just to the question, just kind of yes or no, do you think that the president's executive order would be constitutional if he does it?
Well, I'm not a constitutional expert.
Okay. All right. Mr. Tonko.
Okay, Rachel, to your question, is it wise? No. Is it constitutional? I do not believe so. I believe it's a statement that really reduces us as a nation. The fundamental building block of this nation is families. Families are what we should focus on. And I think the harshness, again, that we have seen with immigrants, with refugees, with now this birthright situation, has caused many people, including Republicans and Democrats in Washington, to speak out forcefully about this issue. Many world-leading nations have that same birthright concept. They honor the family. They honor the individual. And so this is unwise. It's yet another scar across the image of America that speaks against family, against dignity of the individual, and it's not wise, and I don't believe it's constitutional.
All right, and now to Lauren Stanforth with a question for Congressman Tonko.
Yes, it's been less than a week since 11 people were shot to death at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. There have been 298 shooting incidents in 2018 alone that could be considered mass shootings. What role does gun access have in these tragedies? And what should Congress finally do to address this violence?
Well, I do believe that as a nation, we need to revisit common sense legislation, gun safety legislation, school safety legislation. A great majority, perhaps 75 to 80% of gun owners, understand that it's wise to move with background checks. Background checks that determine whether or not a person should be operating a gun or owning a gun. I think that the onslaught that we have seen, and in your question, Lauren, you cited a couple of mass slayings. I talk to colleagues who get one or two deaths a day in their student population, and across the course of a month, it amounts to what is technically a mass slaying. We need to make certain that bump stocks are not allowed. We need to make certain that high-capacity situations are not sold. Do we need assault weapons in our society? There are many issues that are not brought to the floor because of the influence of the NRA. And I think it's regrettable that we do not address safety for our families, for our nation. Again, another pronounced bit of anger, of hate crime, done with a gun that was purchased in Pennsylvania. But we need to go forward and make certain that there aren't cross-border transportation of guns. We need federal policy in some areas, many areas. And when advocates from Newtown, parents pleading with us to do something, are not given the opportunity for the reforms, it tells you that the control rests in the wrong forces.
Mr. Vitullo, what's the best way to respond to gun violence?
First of all, we need to enforce the laws we have on the books. There are tons of laws on the books that are not being enforced. I'm in favor of safe gun activity. I'm in favor of, you know, I'm a hunter. I'm in favor of, people being able to own a gun, have a gun, use a gun for protection for their home, for protection of their family, and to go out hunting and to exercise their Second Amendment right in this country. I don't believe that more laws is the answer. I think the answer is enforcing the ones that we have. And then once we've done that, we can revisit other options.
Matt Ryan, I trust the good people of the Capital Region are still feeding you questions.
They are. A lot of them are questions either we've already asked or we have coming up. This one here goes to Mr. Vitullo, is it?
Correct.
This is now your second run for this congressional seat. You appear to have spent money on Facebook ads, literature, campaign signs, and a website. Your YouTube channel claims you have spent tens of thousands of your own money in the last two election cycles, yet according to the Federal Elections Commission, you have not reported anything. Why is that?
We're actually working on filing them because the first treasurer that I had kind of abandoned me, and so I'm working with them. I did give them a brief filing of everything that I spent last time. I spent a little over $30,000, most of which came out of my own pocket. It's a citizen fund campaign, and so I believe that you know, this whole idea of campaigning and finances is a large issue in this country. I mean, when you have a war chest to work with because you take special interest money, I've turned down money. I've turned down a $100,000 offer.
How come?
Because, was that?
How come?
Because I wasn't going to be influenced by a party. I wasn't going to be influenced by a company. I was not going to be influenced by an organization. I want to represent the people when I go to Washington, D.C. I don't want to represent companies and the, because I, no matter what my opponent says, I have a hard time believing that there is no way that he has ever been influenced with the amount of money that he has taken, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions actually. So I think that there needs to be campaign finance reform, and this is a clear example of it.
Mr. Tonko.
Well, from what I gather from the question from social media is that this form, and I know the form because I've run for office, it's an F3 form, and it requires that we share with the public money that we have collected and money that has been dispensed through the campaign. I don't know if there was an answer to that question from my opponent. If that indeed is factual, then you're going against the grain of accountability, transparency, and integrity, which should rule and govern any campaign and any tenure in office of representation. We need to make certain that if we're candidates and office holders, that we, who write the laws and make laws, also abide by those laws. And if what was stated in this question is accurate, then the F3 form, which the public needs to have, was not granted them.
Okay, and now to Rachel Silberstein with a question for Congressman Tonko.
On a related note, also about corruption, for those of us who closely pay attention to state government, this election cycle has been overshadowed by 6 corruption trials. As the House representative for the Capital Region, to what extent do you believe it's your duty to weigh in on ethics reform in state government?
In state government? I believe that, you know, at all levels of government, there should be sound ethical reform that makes certain that when you denounce the trust placed within you by the general public, that matter should be addressed. I believe that, you know, as we've seen many of these cases come before the public, there is room for reform. I think there's room for making certain that we tighten those situations that maybe have placed a lack of integrity into the forefront, where obviously if we've seen this sort of ethical behavior, it's a broad brush against the entire the complex of Congress. It's very important for us to maintain that sort of integrity in the House. And so any ethical reforms that can advance that imagery is important, because trust is an important factor in the communication and the delivery of policy reforms that will enable us to move forward and address the needs of people. When you see this, we all get broad brushed by this behavior, and it's so it serves the House very well to go forward with ethical reforms that will engage the public in a way that restores trust in the people that they sent to Washington or Albany or serve them in local government.
Mr. Vitola.
I do think there needs to be ethics reform, and I'll just go back to that last question for a moment. Again, I presented everything to the person who I'm dealing with, and they said this is very simple. We're going to help you walk through it. And so there will be full, complete disclosure. There's nothing I have to hide. You can take a look at my truck with 258,000 miles on it, that I'm not putting any money anywhere where it shouldn't go. And as far as ethics reform is concerned, there needs to be incredible ethics reform in the state, because that was the question, and the federal government as well. There are things that are taking place that have to be brought to light and exposed. And part of those things are like the criminal activity that has taken place around the governor. That criminal activity needs to be exposed.
All right, and now to Lauren Stanforth with a question for Mr. Vitolo.
Yes, General Electric, which has 4,000 employees in Schenectady in the 20th Congressional District, just slashed quarterly dividends from 12 cents to 1 cent a share as the company's power division continues to struggle. Does the president's focus on fossil fuels impact companies like GE? And should the government put more resources into the development of renewable energy?
I think that we need to not put, and this is where I disagree with a lot of those who are in Washington. The government should incentivize companies like GE to look at how they can advance renewable energies. I'm all about renewable energies. We need to protect the environment. We have you got Africa, you got South America, you got our environment is being assaulted for making solar panels. They're strip mining Africa for that. So we need to think about how we do all of these things. So when we do renewable energies, we look at renewable energies. We need to look at what we're doing cost effective for what we're getting. I'm in favor of incentivizing people and companies to advance renewable energies. And I don't believe that the answer lies with the government spending more tax dollars. The problem is middle America can't afford another tax dollar. We have to stop raping middle America.
How do you incentivize if you don't use federal monies to do it?
30 seconds.
Well, you give companies an opportunity to do research, and that research could come in form of a tax relief for them. And again, when it comes to streamlining government and making things efficient, we can offset that tax break by streamlining extraordinary expenses in the federal government.
Congressman Tonko.
I'm in constant communication with GE and all of the major employers in the district. And because they have a mission for environment and energy issues, those are my bailiwick. I talk to them routinely. It does no good to pull back a clean power plan that was initiated in the prior administration, because I believe, like 97% of the world's scientists, in the concept of climate change and global warming. We need to reduce carbon in our society. When GE moves down that path, and now we change the rules of the game so that we're denying the clean power plan, we're moving back on transportation with CAFE standards that are being reduced, those are not good concepts. We need to pull ourselves off of fossil-based mentalities and bring us into the age of renewables and clean energy and green thoughts. And GE is ready to go with that, with power plants, where they're serving plants
All
across
right.
the world.
Okay, and once again to Matt Ryan with a question for Congressman Tonko.
37 states currently allow early voting. New York is not one of them. You can vote absentee with a state-approved excuse. Do you support, this is for both of you, of course, do you support early voting, and why or why not?
I believe that we should, as a state, go forward with an early voting idea. I think that it's very important. I've talked to my colleagues from the Northwest who have early voting. I believe it gives people the convenience of being able to fit that into their busy schedule. Perhaps work or family life may interrupt the opportunities to go and vote. It also gives you time to comfortably sit at home and work through some of those initiatives on the ballot. Like when we walk into a voting booth, many times people were not aware of certain referenda or certain candidate slates on the ballot. The early voting provides for that kind of comfort zone. I think there are great benefits that come. We should, as a nation, encourage voting. We should build the numbers. I think they're regrettably low. And the disenfranchising of voters that has been going on with this administration, looking at targets at ways to make it tougher for people to get to the polls, people of minority persuasion having been dealt with unfairly, I think that's a move in the wrong direction, and I would like to see New York go forward with the concept of early voting, providing all the convenience to the voter so that we can maximize the output and allow the electorate to have their voices heard and to have their statements made, which is done each and every election day opportunity. So I stand firmly for growing that opportunity of early voting.
Mr. Vitola.
I'm in favor of expanding opportunities for people to vote, but I am not in favor of doing anything without great caution. We have a problem with corruption in our country, and I believe that the majority of these early voting practices are being pushed by those who have a particular political persuasion. And the fact that people are disenfranchised, listen, I'm going to tell you what I believe. I believe that there should be voter ID. You should show up at the booth with a picture ID, and that you need to prove who you are. I think that's important. This is America. It is sacred. It is a sacred right that we have to vote, and it should be protected. And I know of people who have voted four times in an election during the last time when I worked at White Plains Hospital.
We have time for one more question. It will come from Rachel Silberstein, and it will be for Mr. Vitola.
Mr. Vitola, the president's NAFTA renegotiation deal has gotten mixed reviews from people in the agricultural community in the region. What do you think what is your opinion on the current NAFTA deal on the table?
The new trade deal is, I think, fantastic. I've talked to numerous farmers who said that initially it looked like it was going to be painful for them. But many of them said, we need to do something about unfair trade in this country, and something that benefits Canadian farmers and something that benefits American farmers. And this new deal does benefit both. Before, Canadian farmers benefited much more than American farmers. And because this new deal is going to benefit both, it is a good deal. It's a great deal. And, you know, we have been killing American farms. Matter of fact, over the past 40 years, since my opponent has been over this region, we've lost a family farm every week for the last 25 years. We've seen them go down the drain. And we've been crushing farms with legislation and rules and regulations that are unfair, that are biased, and have actually particularly political choices. So what we need to do, and because it benefited others rather than farmers. We need to strengthen our legislation that will help our farmers, help middle America, because that's where the body and the strength of America is. Middle America, those who pay the taxes, those who pave the way, that's what we should be doing.
Mr. Tonko.
There are standards within trade agreements that cause great concern. For me, amongst some of the highest priorities, labor standards and environmental standards. And beyond that, the implementation of those standards developed in these agreements. The jury's out here for me. I want to make certain that there is this good detailed information as to how those standards have been reformed in this package. That's not clear yet. And there's oftentimes a headline that's offered by the tweeting from this administration without the details. And then what's the implementation about? But when it comes to offshoring jobs, the tax cut bill did damage. I supported the efforts of President Trump to go forward with trade renegotiation. I wanted better deals. I opposed some of the deals made by the Obama administration. But with the tariff implementation, with the tax cut bill that authorized offshoring of jobs, we got to do better than this.
Okay, we started with Twitter. We will end with Twitter as well. Okay, we are approaching the end of our broadcast. The formal questioning is now over, and each candidate will have 1 minute for a closing statement as determined beforehand. Congressman Tonko will go first. Thank you. Your minute begins right now.
Thank you, everyone, for watching, and thank you, WMHT. If I return to office, I pledge to work very hard on building America, building the individual and family with workforce development programs that enable them to function adequately in an innovation economy. Healthcare protections with the pre-existing protections that need to continue for our individuals and families, making certain that the opioid epidemic is resolved because it's taking too many of our loved ones. Then building the infrastructure, making certain not just roads and bridges, but grid modernization, certainly broadband access, water infrastructure on which I've worked, and then finally building our government, making certain accountability and transparency is the outcome, making certain that reforms for campaign finance reform enable us to push forward. The strength of the general public out there, the electorate, the middle class values are maintained by making certain that we give the power to the many, not the money in government. We need that building also. Build our infrastructure, human infrastructure, capital infrastructure, our government infrastructure. And thank you so much for the opportunity
and
this
now,
evening.
And now with our final closing statement, Mr. Vitolo.
Well, as I started with, I will finish with, and that is that the average working person, the average working class person needs to be represented in America. We talked about people who come here and have babies here. What about the people who live here? What about the poor people in Schenectady and Amsterdam and Albany and Troy? What about those poor people? What are we doing for them and their children? I want to know how we're helping Americans before we start thinking about helping other people from outside this country, which I'm in favor of. Secondly, I think that if I went to Washington, and I know exactly what I would do, I would work at rebuilding this area. We have the oldest infrastructure in the country in this area. We want to bring the $40 billion that leave this state. I want to bring those dollars back. Build our water systems, build our sewage treatment systems, build our roads and our highways so that companies and manufacturing will come and stay, and you'll have a job.
Mr. Tonko, Mr. Vitolo, I want to thank you both very much for taking part in this debate. I also want to thank our outstanding panel from the Times Union, Rachel Silberstein, Lauren Stanforth, and, of course, my partner on New York Now, Matt Ryan. A reminder, you can watch this full debate all over again from now until Election Day. Just head to our website, nynow.org or wmht.org. And of course, we'll catch you up on all the week's news and analysis Friday night at 7:30 on our weekly version of New York Now. From all of us here, thanks so much for watching. Have a good night, and don't forget to vote on November 6th.